Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at something that, well, it challenges some really basic ideas about why things feel so difficult in modern society. We're exploring this fascinating paper. It crosses disciplines and it puts forward a pretty radical thought. Maybe the huge crises we see, burnout, chronic disease, the political divides, mistrust in institutions, maybe they aren't primarily moral or political failures.
Right. The sources argue they're actually physiological failures and relational ones.
Physiological, meaning in the body.
Exactly, in the body. The paper's claim is basically that we're trying to fix things like polarization with better messages or, you know, ideology debates.
Trying to persuade people.
Persuade, yeah. But we're starting at the wrong end. We're trying to fix the top of the pyramid when the actual foundation, the biological foundation is, well, it's shaking.
Okay, so the mission for this deep dive is to unpack that core idea. That culture doesn't just interact with our biology, it grows out of it. That our institutions, our whole social structure, are fundamentally built on whether our nervous systems can handle cooperation, whether they feel safe.
And that brings us to the central finding, really. The human nervous system, yours and mine, everyone's, is being constantly pushed into defense states. Fight or flight, freeze.
By modern life.
By the environment, the pace, the lack of safety cues, And society is basically just reorganizing itself around that chronic dysregulation. That's the big claim.
Wow.
And that's why the usual fixes aren't working. You can't just convince someone to trust or cooperate if their body is screaming danger. Belief doesn't lead biology here. The body leads the mind.
Okay, so how do we get from cells sensing danger to, say, political polarization? The paper uses a couple of key concepts here, right? Coherence infrastructure and the coherence cascade.
That's right. The cascade explains how it scales up, and the infrastructure is about, well, what we need to build to fix it. Let's get into the framework they use.
Okay, so the starting point is actually an older idea from anthropology Marvin Harris's Cultural Materialism. I remember this from way back. Harris argued culture isn't shaped by ideas first, but by the material stuff, right? Energy, environment.
Exactly. Bottom up, not top down from beliefs. The base layer shapes everything else.
But how does a theory about, like, farming methods help us understand today's digital world and, you know, Twitter wars?
Well, it gives us a structure, a map. Harris had these three levels, remember?
Yeah. Infrastructure, structure, superstructure.
Right. Infrastructure.
Yeah.
The absolute base, energy, food, environment, our biological limits. Then structure, how we organize institutions, social roles, governance. And finally, superstructure, the world of ideas, values, beliefs, identity, narratives.
Okay. Makes sense. So where's the leap?
The leap is connecting our neurobiology directly to those levels. This is what they call the coherence cascade. They're saying the infrastructure, that base layer, it's fundamentally biological. It's about our internal state.
So not just food and energy from the environment, but energy inside us.
Precisely. They map specific biological systems, like mitoception, basically, how our cells sense their own energy levels and our immune tone, you know, inflammation levels. Those things are the infrastructure.
So low cellular energy or high inflammation is like a weak foundation for the whole cultural building.
That's the idea. Think of mitochondria as the power grid for society. If it's constantly flickering in a brownout state, your brain isn't going to prioritize abstract thought or cooperation. It prioritizes survival. Vigilance.
Okay, then the next level up, structure.
That maps onto our relational patterns, how we interact, how safe we feel with each other, and the tempo of our institutions, our governance, how fast things move.
And superstructure is still the beliefs identity.
Beliefs identity, shared meaning, culture in the way we usually think of it. That's the top layer.
So the core insight is, wow, if you want a society that works, one that can actually cooperate and solve problems and, you know, bounce back from difficulties, you have to start with the body. You need conditions where nervous systems can actually regulate, feel safe, have enough energy.
You got it. If the foundation is built on exhausted, inflamed, stressed out bodies, the whole cultural structure on top is inevitably going to be defensive, reactive, unstable.
Okay, let's dive deeper into that foundation, the physiological infrastructure. You said civilization starts at the cell with mitoception, cellular energy sensing.
Yeah, think of it as the body constantly asking, do I have enough energy right now to deal with this, to connect, to think long term?
The first condition of civilization, they call it.
Right, because if the answer is no, if energy is chronically low or unstable, which, let's face it, is common with modern stress, poor diet, lack of sleep. The whole system shifts. It goes into short-term survival mode. Cooperation, empathy, creativity. Those things take metabolic energy. They're luxuries you can't afford when you're running on empty.
Okay. Then there's immunoception, inflammation as a cultural signal. Now, this one, I mean, are they really saying political fights are driven by, like, immune system activity? That sounds reductionist.
It does sound bold, I know. But the argument isn't about specific political beliefs. It's about the readiness for conflict versus cooperation.
How so?
Chronic inflammation, physiologically, makes us more irritable. It makes us perceive threats more easily in ambiguous situations, like someone's tone of voice or facial expression. It biases us towards defense.
So an inflamed population is jumpy, reactive.
Essentially, yes. The paper is quite blunt. A population that's chronically inflamed and metabolically stressed will tend towards polarization and conflict, almost regardless of the specific issues they're arguing about. Their bodies are primed for it. So public health isn't just about individual well-being. It's literally cultural infrastructure.
Wow. Okay. And then interoception. That's our internal body sense.
Yeah, your felt sense. Yeah. How clearly you perceive your own internal state, your heartbeat, your gut feelings, muscle tension. They call it the bridge to meaning.
Why a bridge?
Because it's what allows you to navigate complexity, to feel discomfort or uncertainty internally without immediately reacting or shutting down. If you can't feel yourself clearly, if your interception is kind of muddy or confusing,
you jump to conclusions, black and white thinking.
Exactly. You can't tolerate ambiguity, internally or externally, so you escalate quickly. The capacity for nuance, for deliberation, for democracy itself, they argue, rests on populations having bodies that can feel themselves with some clarity.
Okay, last one in this layer. Neuroception. You mentioned this earlier, the non-conscious detection of safety.
Yeah, Stephen Porges' concept. It's your nervous system's background scanner, constantly asking, is this person, this place, this situation safe? Way below your conscious awareness.
So it's not a thought, it's a feeling, a state.
It's even deeper than a feeling. It's an implicit physiological assessment. Is the environment signaling threat or safety? Think about walking into a room. You instantly get a vibe, right? That's partly neuroception.
Right.
So if a whole population's neuroception is constantly picking up cues of threat, maybe from noise, unstable work, social isolation, even the architecture around them, that collective state is the culture, in a way.
Culture as the distribution of autonomic states. Fight, flight, freeze versus safe and social.
Precisely. That's the physiological infrastructure.
Mm.
So if that's the foundation, the next logical step is, how do we build environments that actually support regulation? That's where coherence infrastructure comes in. It's about the tangible stuff, the measurable design choices.
Right, making it practical. So starting with physical space, the built environment as a nervous system scaffold. What does that mean? How is a building like a scaffold for my nerves?
Think about it. Urban design is collective neuroregulation, whether we intend it or not. A really dense, loud, visually cluttered city street. What does that do to your nervous system?
Winds it up, probably. Makes you alert, maybe a bit stressed.
Exactly. Increases sympathetic load vigilance. Coherence infrastructure would intentionally design for the opposite, for what Porges calls ventral vagal dominance, that safe, socially engaged state.
How? What does that look like?
Things like access to green spaces, reducing noise pollution, using natural soundscapes, ensuring human-scale sightlines so your brain isn't overwhelmed. It's about embedding cues of safety into the environment itself. Building hostile public spaces literally architects instability into the population.
Okay, that makes sense. The bit about time as infrastructure really hit home for me. The constant rush, the overflowing email, the 24/7 news. It feels like we're always behind, always bracing for the next thing.
It's huge, isn't it? That chronic anticipatory stress. The paper argues the sheer speed of modern institutional life is maybe the biggest driver of dysregulation. Our nervous systems just didn't evolve for this pace. They can't metabolize information and experience that fast.
So what's the coherence infrastructure solution for time? Slow everything down.
It's about re-regulating the collective rhythm. Things like protecting sleep, really protecting it culturally, ensuring people have predictable time for meals, not just grabbing something on the run, designing governance processes that have a deliberative rhythm, not constant crisis mode,
building pauses in.
Building pauses, predictability, and a humane tempo into the structure of our days and our institutions. Time itself needs to be treated as vital infrastructure for well-being.
And back to the cell's metabolic stability. If mitochondria are the first site of civilization,
then feeding them properly becomes a core task of cultural design, right? Nutrition policy isn't just about health. It's about creating a regulated populace. Water security isn't just logistics, it's emotional stability policy.
And not just any food, but food that's metabolically stabilizing.
Yeah, avoiding the massive blood sugar spikes and crashes from highly processed stuff.
Yeah.
And thinking about distribution community gardens, local food systems, ways that food also builds connection, not just calories delivered in isolation.
Which leads nicely into public space. You mentioned we've kind of privatized regulation and we use our phones, our cars, headphones to manage our state. What did we lose?
We lost the power of shared regulatory practices. Think about traditional societies, communal meals, singing together, dancing, seasonal rituals. These were technologies for bringing the group's nervous systems into sync, into coherence.
Co-regulation on a community scale.
Exactly. Coherence infrastructure means reclaiming that. Creating public spaces, plazas, parks, libraries, community centers, where people can simply be together without needing to consume or pay. Where you can sit on a bench and feel part of something. These aren't luxuries. They're essential repair mechanisms for the collective nervous system.
Okay, so we've built a better foundation with coherence infrastructure. Now let's move up to the structure layer, our institutions. How do things like hospitals or schools either stabilize us or make things worse? Starting with healthcare as a cultural nervous system. That's an interesting phrase.
It highlights the relational aspect. Ironically, hospitals can often be incredibly dysregulating environments, right? The noise, the lights, the urgency, the fear.
For patients and staff.
Absolutely. Staff burnout is rampant. And the paper makes this really provocative point. The core clinical skill isn't just diagnosis or procedure. It's the clinician's ability to maintain a regulated presence, especially under pressure.
Meaning staying calm and connected.
Yes. Because remarkably, research shows a patient's physiology, like their heart rate variability, can actually entrain or sync up with a regulated clinician. Your calm literally calms their body.
So if the staff are stressed and dysregulated,
they can inadvertently amplify the patient's distress, compromising the healing environment itself. Staff regulation isn't a soft skill or a wellness perk. It's fundamental clinical quality infrastructure. It needs to be designed in.
Let's apply that to schools as developmental co-regulation systems.
Mm-hmm.
Kids spend so much time there. Schools are basically training grounds for their nervous systems.
They absolutely are. We're teaching them how to manage attention, emotions, social interactions, all mediated by the nervous system. But think about the typical school environment.
Fluorescent lights, bells ringing, hard chairs, sitting still for long periods.
Right. It often induces a state of bracing, hypervigilance, or shutdown.
Mm.
Then we label kids as having attention problems or being disruptive.
When maybe the environment is the problem.
That's the argument. A coherence-based school would prioritize things differently. Predictable rhythms and routines. Regular movement breaks like every 20, 40 minutes. Sensory-friendly classrooms. Quieter spaces.
And what about when things go wrong? Conflict happens.
The key principle shifts from zero tolerance to zero abandonment. The focus is on repair, modeled publicly and non-punitively.
So not just punishment, but actually teaching kids how to reconnect after a rupture.
Exactly. The adults model it. The institution shows that conflict is normal, but the goal is always to repair the connection, to regulate together. You stay with the difficulty. You don't just isolate or punish. That teaches resilience at a nervous system level.
Okay, bringing this up to governance. If we extend these ideas, the message seems to be that legitimacy, trust in government or institutions isn't just about policies or communication.
It's fundamentally physiological. Do people feel safe and seen by the institution? Trust is built through predictability, responsiveness at a human tempo, not getting lost in bureaucracy and relational continuity. You know, actually being able to deal with the same person or team.
So fancy websites and communication strategies can't paper over a system that feels slow, chaotic, or uncaring to interact with?
Precisely. The embodied experience of interacting with the institution is the message that lands in the nervous system. And that's what determines real trust and legitimacy, far more than any press release.
So we've covered infrastructure and structure. Now we arrive at the top. Superstructure meaning identity, culture, and how it all feeds back. The paper says identity is a kind of predictive model for staying regulated. What does that mean?
It means your sense of self, who you think you are, is partly shaped by what strategies have kept you feeling relatively safe and connected in your environment. So if your environment feels unsafe, if belonging feels conditional or precarious, your identity might become more rigid, more defensive.
As a shield.
As a shield, yeah. A way to maintain predictability and control in an unpredictable relational world. And the key point here is that deeply held narratives and identities tend to shift after people have new experiences of safety and connection in their bodies, not usually before. You can't just talk someone out of a defensive identity.
Which explains why trying to change minds first often fails.
Right. So what happens when this whole system, body, relationships, institution starts breaking down? We get caught in the breakdown loop.
Explain that loop.
It's when dysregulation cascades upwards and then feeds back down. So stress in the body leads to ruptures in relationships, which destabilizes institutions, which fragments culture and shared meaning. And that fragmented, unsafe culture then creates more stress in the body.
A vicious cycle.
Exactly. And the paper argues this is what leads to things like rising authoritarianism, deep social divides, institutional decay. It's not necessarily a moral decline in the way we usually think of it. It's more like a collective autonomic capture. The whole system gets stuck in a defensive state.
But there's a way out, a critical lever.
Yes, and that lever is repair.
Repair. We mentioned it in school.
It's crucial at every level. The defining feature of a healthy, coherent culture isn't that it never experiences conflict or rupture that's impossible. It's how reliably and effectively it can return to repair.
And repair isn't just saying sorry.
No, it's deeper. It's about physiological reconnection. It's the process of co-regulating, of moving nervous systems out of a defensive state, fight, flight, freeze, back into that safe, socially engaged state together. It's demonstrating through action that connection can be restored after a break.
Okay, so this leads to their action plan, the transformation roadmap. It seems to follow the cascade upwards.
It does. It's a four-phase cycle starting at the base.
Right.
Regulate. Stabilize the body and the immediate environment. That's the foundation. Create physiological safety.
Two.
Relate. Build trust and belonging in the interpersonal field. Practice co-regulation and repair.
Three.
Reorganize. Adapt institutions and governance to support regulation and cooperation. Embed human tempo.
And finally, four.
Restory. Allow new narratives, identities, and shared meanings to emerge from the felt experience of safety and connection. Create a truly regenerative culture.
So it's iterative. You start with the body, move to relationships, then institutions, and finally, culture catches up. And that new culture then supports the body better.
Exactly. It's pragmatic. It's incremental. You don't leap to changing beliefs first. You start by building the actual physical relational conditions that allow nervous system to calm down, to move out of constant vigilance.
Because things like creativity, compassion, long-term thinking,
they're metabolic luxuries. They require a surplus of energy and regulatory capacity.
Mm-hmm.
You have to create the conditions for presence before you can expect those higher order functions to emerge reliably. We have to earn them through intentional, biologically informed design.
So the final takeaway then, it's surprisingly practical. A coherent civilization isn't some abstract ideal. It's one that structurally supports emotional and metabolic repair. It builds it in.
Mm-hmm. Coherence isn't a fixed destination we arrive at.
Nice.
It's a rhythm. A rhythm of connection, rupture, and repair that we learn to maintain together.
So maybe the provocative thought for you, the listener, is to consider this in your own context. What would actually change if your workplace or your kid's school or even your local council genuinely adopted tempo regulation as a core principle?
Yeah.
What if the systems you interact with were deliberately designed to move at a pace that allowed for reflection, for connection, for actual human processing instead of just relentless, stressful urgency? What might become possible then? That's something to reflect on from this deep dive.